Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Welcome to New Books in Biography. I'm Online Eaton. It's likely that most listeners know something of the life of Sylvia Plath, a stunningly talented American poet who committed suicide in the brutally cold London winter of 1963. But have you read her novel? The Bell Jar, published in the UK that year, wouldn't be released in the US until 1971, and it is the events that inspired this semi-autobiographical account that lay at the heart of Elizabeth Winder's new book, entitled Pain Parties Work, Sylvia Plath in New York, summer of 1953. Hi, Elizabeth. Thank you so much for joining us for New Books and Biography today. I wonder if you could just kick things off by telling us a little bit about yourself.
I guess the most important thing about myself is that I'm really a poet. I mean, that's what I was trained to be. I have an MFA, and it's a creative writing MFA, and it's with a poetry concentration. And, you know, when I was in college, I pretty much exclusively wrote poetry. And then I had to write some, English papers, but those were always done really badly. So I've always been a poet, and I've never really tried anything else. Mm-hmm. Even though for years, probably since 2005 or earlier, I love to read nonfiction, especially biographies of women. So, you know, obviously, I think it's a natural thing to gradually begin to write what you read, I think.
Right. Do you remember when you first encountered Sylvia Plath in your own life?
I do, yeah. I was 14, and I was in high school, and a friend of mine was reading a copy of The Bell Jar, and it was this old 70s cover of this very, like, sort of gothic-looking rose with sort of sharp edges hanging upside down, and this, like, big black lettering. And he lent me the book because I was really curious about it, and I had heard the name Sylvia Plath before, and I didn't really, know who she was. And I remember reading the book, and I remember that it smelled so deeply of cigarettes. The book did, because my son's mother smoked, and I thought that was really glamorous. So I never, like, owned an object that reeked of cigarettes before. So I thought that was pretty cool. And then I just fell in love with the language. Mm-hmm. And I remember specifically just really becoming obsessed with the character Doreen, because, well, I thought her name was fantastic, it was like 50s name, and I just thought that she was the most glamorous person on earth, and I loved how irreverent she was, and I loved that she always knew how much to, like, tip the bellhop and all this stuff. So I became really attached to the book, and I also just thought the book was so funny. Mm-hmm. Particularly in the descriptions of the Esther's boyfriend, the Buddy Willard character, when he's like that awful scene where, like, he takes off his underwear, and of course, like, Sylvia Plath is, like, describing the underwear, it's like mesh, like fishnet or something, and he drapes it really neatly across the back of the chair, and it's just, like, so awful, and it's just funny, and mm-hmm. It seems very real to me. And, so then very quickly, I asked her, this was, like, for Christmas or my birthday or something, to more Sylvia Plath, and I got her collected poems, and it's a very, I still have it, it's a very attractive book, I think, I love the way it looks. Mm-hmm. So then I just, like, fell very deeply in love with the way she uses language and the vividness of it, and it really, and I was still young, I was, 14 or 15, I had known for a long time I wanted to be a writer and that I wanted to be a poet. So, and I really think that her sense of language and her attention, this, like, exquisite attention to detail and syllables, is kind of it was important for me when I formed my idea of what writing is and what I wanted to do with it. So Sylvia Plath had a lot to do with that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So is this the first time you've really written about her?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
And what drew you to this particular, because this is a partial life biography, it just focuses on the time in New York. What drew you to that particular time in her life, and why did you decide to do a partial life rather than a full life?
Well, I never thought that I'd write nonfiction. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think for years I'd sort of been hoping that I would. But I like to focus, no matter what I'm writing, I like to focus on a small thing, like an image, a detail, a certain amount of time. I like details. I like physical, sensual details that I think are almost like cinematic in a way. And I think when you're looking at the broad scope of a life, anyone's life, it's difficult to really focus on those small relatable things. So I've always been drawn to, like, I tend to narrow rather than broaden out my focus, I guess. But regarding Sylvia Plath, I've read probably almost every biography written about her, and there's so many, and some of them I really like and are quite good, but I've always thought it was odd that none of her biographers really seem to kind of gloss over this summer in her life, mm-hmm. and sort of race through it, like impatient to get to the wild disaster at the end, where she attempts suicide. And I think that it's so much more than that. It was so much more than that. It was just really, she was 20 years old, and it was this really crucial period of her life. Like, not even a period, it's a matter of weeks, but I think it's a really interesting kind of look at. No one else is doing it. And plus, you have this wonderful, I mean, this is like the first time in her life that she was taken out of New England. Mm-hmm. So, and this is someone who's used to, like, Wellesley and Smith, and now she's in New York, and it's something completely different and new for her. And I think that's interesting, too.
Yeah. So what sources were most helpful? You were able to interview the women, the other interns, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's mm-hmm. right. That's like a huge source in my book. I don't know what I would have done without them. Mm-hmm.
Was there anything else that was helpful that you were able to get access to? Or I know the diaries, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Right. And those have been, published. Mm-hmm. Sylvia's journals weren't a huge source for me. I mean, she really didn't write about this at all, period. Which I think is really wild in itself and says something, because mm-hmm. she was such a journal keeper, no matter how busy she was, for her whole life. So I thought that intrigued me, that fact intrigued me. So in terms of other sources, I went to the Plath Archives in the Lilly Library. It's the library of the School of the University of Indiana in Bloomington. Mm-hmm. And so they have a ton of, in fact, I think that most of the Sylvia Plath archives are there. In fact, not even at Smith, although there's some at Smith, but that was I love research, and it's like by far the research is the fun part mm-hmm. for me. So I went there twice, actually, and I to the Lilly Library, and I just loved every minute of it. And they have they have so many things. At first I thought, I'm going to be looking at everything, and that was never going to happen. I saw that. That was a real high point for me. I'm sorry, a little bit of a cough. So in terms of what was there, was this really big folder on all of the Mademoiselle related stuff, mm-hmm. like all of the documents and the handouts they gave her, the schedule, the things that she wrote to apply as a guest editor were all there. And so there was a lot there, and that was kind of step one, was piecing together the framework of the month. And then, of course, I looked at other things in the archives, like she was a probably like a lot of sort of you know, educated, bookish type of her age. She was a really big letter writer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she wrote a lot of letters, but she always had tons of, I mean, most of her letters were either to her mother or to different guys that she happened to be dating. So, but she's very, she's a great letter writer and very, you know, had this very breezy sort of tone that made you feel like you were just kind of talking on the phone. And she was very candid in her letters. So I read as many letters as I could from the, what year am I thinking about now? If it was anywhere in 1952, 1953, mm-hmm. 1954, maybe even 1951, I was reading it. And those were just amazing. I forgot about this. In the archives, there are also letters that were sent to her from different boyfriends, and some of those were just so funny, mm-hmm. so funny, and I just loved it. There was in particular just a guy that he was sort of like a pen pal, but there were a few failed attempts at a romance, you know. But the letters from him were particularly great because I could just picture this type of guy. I looked at a picture of him, and he was, you know, he had this leather bomber jacket, he was wearing aviator sunglasses, and he was from Chicago, and I think he's sort of like, you know, posing as this kind of like Jack Kerouac type guy, and he's, you know, writing, and he's clearly like a very, very smart guy, and mm-hmm. you could really see why they were friends and why they were sort of corresponding. But towards the letters began to take on, his letters to her took on this very bitter sort of tone after there was an incident where, you know, they went out on a date and it didn't go so well. And it was just it was just amazing, you know, because he was talking about, oh, he's, you know, he's engaged now. And I talked about this in my book, this girl Sue that he's going to marry, and he's telling Sylvia, and it's pretty obvious he's trying to make her jealous. And you know, and it's like kind of horrifying the way he talks about his current girlfriend. Like he's saying how, you know, her spelling is really good, but she's not creative. It's just like, you know, she's not too pretty, but she's pretty enough. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just really, really terrible. So it's just so funny. And so I love doing that. I love going through all of those documents. And you know what, I read her Sylvia's journals from when she was, you know, a teenager and younger, mm-hmm. those aren't published. And I loved looking at those because you really saw her personality.
Right.
So all of that was just so fantastic for me.
Sounds great. She came to New York to do an internship at Mademoiselle. Who did she work for? And what was the daily routine of that like?
She worked for all of the guest editors, as they called it, interns, were sort of assigned a Mademoiselle editor. They were just kind of like a shadow, and that woman would sort of be her boss. So Sylvia's boss was the managing editor, and her name was Sarah Lee Abels. And I think that from what I understand, and from every single woman that I talked to who was a part of that month, they all basically said the same thing, which was that Sylvia worked so much harder than everyone else. Not because she wanted to, but because her job was different. And I go into this detail in my book. The editors, it seems like the editors were kind of divided between what they would call the literary ones and the visual ones. The visual ones would have jobs that had more to do with, you know, fashion and beauty and things like that, whereas Sylvia's work was really kind of putting the magazine together. Mm-hmm. And she did have some, the high points of her work would have been, you know, communicating with different writers, because Shirley Abels was a very literary woman, and, you know, she was the friend of Dylan Thomas, you know, mm-hmm. which was why there was the Dylan Thomas fiasco was that month. And so Sylvia would be on the phone and communicating with different people, and you know, you could tell that she really liked that from her letters home. Mm-hmm. But there was a lot of, you know, copy editing and things like that, and just being stuck to the desk. And the other girls would, as part of their work, they would go to fashion shows and things like that. And, you know, Sylvia didn't always get to do that stuff. So I think that the work was kind of hard on her. And there was also quite a bit of technical things that she had to do. And, you know, she wasn't expecting that. And as someone who's also, you know, like, I mean, I would be so upset if I had to do something like that. And I was thinking that I was going to be part of this really creative, glamorous sort of thing. Right. So I think the work was hard on her, and she wasn't always suited to it.
Mm-hmm. And it does sound like she was, since she was kind of separated out from the other girls on her own. Yeah. Did she become close with any of them?
She did. Yeah. She became closest to a woman named Carol LaVarne, who sort of provided Sylvia with the basis for the Doreen character, except that, you know, I spoke with Carol, and she wasn't that much like Doreen at all, at least, mm-hmm. you know, on the surface. But anyway, so they became very, very good friends, and they had a lot of fun adventures together, and she was also quite close with Neva, who's a big presence in my book. I, mm-hmm. you know, interviewed her, and she had kept all this stuff and all these letters. And Sylvia was also friends with Janet Wagner, who kind of provided the inspiration behind the Beljar character, Betsy, who they call the Pollyanna cowgirl. And she was from Tennessee, and, you know, very, very, very naive, very, very friendly. Immediately got her, like, long hair, long braids cut off into this very pretty bob haircut, and she ended up staying in New York to be a model because she was approached by a model style from Ford Models. So those would have been the women that Sylvia was the closest to, but it sounds like she was pretty friendly with almost everyone.
Mm-hmm. So I think in the cultural imagination, Plath kind of exists as this is more the poet of the early 60s. That's how we think of her. And we don't really see her as being really glamorous, or it seems kind of like a disconnect that she would love fashion, but she did. And that's a subject that plays a substantial role in your book. So what was her relationship with fashion and with makeup?
Well, she just, she loved it. She loved all of it. You know, she was someone who is, and I think that this wouldn't come as a surprise if, it didn't come as a surprise as someone has read, you know, her poetry and, right. and her journals. She's what I would call very, like, physical poet. She's very tied to the physical world. You know, she's not talking, you know, there are ideas, but it's always rooted in an object, in a thing that you can touch, and, you know, very textural. So you know, she's someone who is really tied to the physical, and who's a very visual person. You know, one of the things about Sylvia Plath is she was also a visual artist, mm-hmm. and, a pretty good one too. So it's not really a disconnect when you think about it. So you know, she from a very young age just loved clothes, like a lot of us. I think that maybe she appreciated them even more because she couldn't just go out and buy whatever she wanted. Mm-hmm. Although the year before, in the months coming, leading up to the Mademoiselle internship, she spent so much money on clothes. And it wasn't all about the Mademoiselle thing. I think that it was kind of a tough year for her, her third year at Smith. So she sort of, shopping became something that she did to relax and to kind of perk herself up. But she, and she loved makeup too. She loved red lipstick. She wore red lipstick for a whole duration of her life. And I think it was something that she felt, it, you know, the whole idea of femininity was really important to her. Mm-hmm. And it was something she thought about a lot and what it meant. And in the 50s, and I think even today, there's this idea that you couldn't, I think a very, very sexist idea that a woman, but she was going to be intellectual, whether a writer or anything else. Then she sort of had to either give up or at least appear incredibly disinterested in clothes and makeup and all of that visual presentation. Right. And I think I know that made Sylvia angry and resentful because you can read it in the journals. You know, she's thinking about it, and she's looking desperately for role models of women who are writers, but who don't fit what they would call back then, like, the blue stocking stereotype, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, it's...
And, you know, the other one that I can think of is, and this is someone who I think is far more glamorous than Sylvia, and they were friends, would be Anne Sexton.
Right.
And I think that's probably one of the reasons why Anne Sexton stands out, you know, those images of her. She's actually good for modeling, I think.
I think that
you know, it was a big theme in my book, and it's one of the reasons why I chose to write about this subject and this month in her life, because the idea of the feminine and beauty and fashion, those and what that meant within the context of an intellectual writing woman, those were constant themes in Sylvia's life, constant. So I wanted to look at all that stuff, and I thought it was interesting.
No, it's really fascinating. You've also got, as we mentioned, you did many interviews with the other interns. What were their memories of Plath?
They were really varied.
Mm-hmm.
Really varied. Some of them remember her as, they all remember her as very, very pretty, very smiley, always smiling, with really, really bright, straight white teeth. Kind of like the classic, like an American smile with the white teeth. And they all remember her red lipstick. And they all remember her very, very shiny hair. And she kind of had, at least at that time, she kind of had shampoo model hair. Or at the time, the shampoo was either Halo or Breck. And they had the girls, a lot of times, most of the shampoo models were blonde. And they had... you know, the little page boy haircut, and so Sylvia had that look, and, you know, she definitely had solidified that look at that point, so they all remember her physical detail, and in terms of her personality, that's where I got really different perspectives, and some remember being a little bit up and down, not moody, but a lot of them remember her just being really tired at the office and sort of exhausted towards the end, which really makes sense when you think about how much work she was doing and the fact that Sylvia was someone who, she wasn't the type of person who would say, okay, well, I've had a really long day at work and I'm actually going to not stay out till 5 in the morning. She's going to stay out till 5 in the morning too, because she doesn't want to miss out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things that I found very endearing about her. So she was pretty worn out by the end, and the other editors noticed that. I think that they all noticed that she had, even if she was tired, she had that energy, and she wanted to go out a lot, was always asking people, well, you know, let's go to this place or that place. And they remember her as being pretty social. But some of the memories are a little unusual. I'm trying to think of one. Oh, yeah. There was some people noticed some of the observations that she made, and they could tell that she was constantly sort of a little bit judgmental, I think, and maybe a little bit snobby about being from the East Coast and going to Smith and things like that. I think that she sort of saw herself as a little bit set above some of the other women. And then Neva remembers in very vivid detail Sylvia's behavior on the morning that the Rosenbergs were to be executed. And Sylvia was very, very upset about that and sort of, you know, shaking and very upset at breakfast, and then wandered into the subway by herself, and she sort of broke out into this rash, and it was a very, very intense, kind of unforgettable moment.
You've mentioned her social life. What was her social life like during this month in New York?
It was really busy. She was a lot of the stuff was taken up with scheduled Mademoiselle events, like, for example, the dance at the St. Regis Ball. That was sort of the high point of the social calendar for them. And So there was that. And then there were a few things that they kind of did on their own. The night that me and Carol stayed up all night at the Chelsea Hotel waiting for Dylan Thomas to come out of his room, and they never saw him. So that was fun, you know. Mm-hmm. And then they just did the stuff, I think, that you know, 20-year-olds would do today. They met random guys on the street and went to, you know, a bar in the village with them and stayed up dancing. Also, Sylvia had some... She knew some people in New York, so she had already set up a few dates on her own, so she could go out on a few dates. She really liked the village, and she was hanging out there and different bistros and stuff like that, drinking wine. They went to jazz clubs, things like that. It was pretty full.
Yeah.
It was a pretty full calendar.
So you have an anecdote in the book about how Mademoiselle ran the intern's handwriting through analysis. What did the analysis of Plath's handwriting reveal?
Let me take a look, because I want to make sure I get this right. I thought this was really interesting.
Yeah, it really was. Because it was from when she submitted, right? It was the original application.
Yeah, and it was really crazy because they didn't really... When you looked at the instructions that the Mademoiselle staff was giving to the girls who wanted to apply, it was kind of sneaky how they managed to get the handwriting sample. It was, I mean, they didn't just come out and ask for it. Which, mm-hmm. And I thought, well, you know, if it were me, I would have just given it to them. So I thought that was kind of neat. Let's see. If you've ever seen a copy of Sylvia Plath's handwriting, I really like it. It's very mm-hmm. round, and it's very feminine, but there's something very simple about it. You know, I'm having so much time saying it. But anyway, I remember a lot mm-hmm. of it. It said that she was, I want to find the actual thing. She was, the person picked up on very perfectionist overtones. And it said that she was, it looked like that she was sort of identified more from the handwriting expert as a visual artist than a writer, which is interesting considering the fact that the editors kind of ignored that, mm-hmm. you know. And the handwriting expert also apparently wrote to Betsy Talbot Blackwell, the Mademoiselle editor, saying that one of her girls was headed towards the nervous breakdown, and that in fact was Sylvia, which was really kind of, I mean, that just sort of gave me the chills in a way.
Yeah.
That he could tell just from this. And the sample was very, very small. It was really small. In the magazine, they had they would do this for every college issue. They would have, you know, a little picture of the guest editor and a teeny tiny little bio, you know, just a line or two. And then a copy of the signature. And then they would give a little fragment of the handwriting analysis, but only the good part. So, you know, not the bad part. Mm-hmm. So in Sylvia's good part, it says, you know, very artistic and, you know, very driven and, you know, a real sense of the visual, but it doesn't say the other stuff.
Mm-hmm. So this is a really broad question, but what was the significance of this period, this month in New York? What was the significance of it in her life overall, do you think, to her? What did it mean to her?
Well, I think, for one, I think that, I think that when you're 20 years old, like I am, for better or worse, and I think that in a way it's kind of sad that it doesn't quite work like this when you get older, but a month or like a period or even a week or a set period of time can just be so... I remember times like this in my life when I was like about 10 years ago where it's just like you see it in Technicolor and mm-hmm. and you just feel like a different person. Do you know what I mean? Like
you feel
you're a different person. Or like it's like or like you're in your own movie or like it's a separate life apart from your regular life mm-hmm. almost. And that you've already lived one full lifetime in some, like, 1 week or 5 week period. And I had the sense that this was kind of like that for her. And the more I the more I researched it, the more I realized that it really was. And so, you know, I think it's really hard to look back and to say, because of this experience, this is why this happened, or this is why that happened. So it wasn't really about that for me. It was more about, an interesting thing to me was, I think that this month had a, what I really know that it did was it helped her. It was really instrumental in her forming her own idea of herself and how she saw herself, which I think is probably the biggest thing. And I think that, for Warren, she realized after this month that she didn't really want to work in editing or publishing or anything like that, that she really was, you know, an artist and just like someone who needed to have like free reign of her own creative mind. And she seemed to leave the month being very confident that, you know, she's a writer, not, you know, magazine editor. So in terms of concrete stuff, there was that. And I also think that it gave her, you know, she left New York feeling very exhausted, very broken. But when you look at the aftermath, I think that it gave her a lot of confidence. Mm-hmm. And I think that it helped her sort of be, you know, and it's only 1953, and I think that it sort of helped her see herself as more of a modern woman and a lot more bold and not just kind of like a, you know, as she would put it, like a schoolgirl in Bobby Fox, like waiting for a guy to pick her up for a date. She became a lot more sort of on surface glamorous, you know, with very, very blonde hair and, you know, sort of bold, more bold kind of clothes. And, you know, after this month, she had a very, very progressive attitude towards dating and men, mm-hmm. extremely progressive for the time. She no longer became remotely concerned about, you know, reputation or this or that or being considered good and all this stuff. And for that time, for 1953, for a girl of her background, that was pretty impressive, I think.
Yeah.
She sort of took control of her own life. And so in a way, I think that it did have a big impact. Mm-hmm. And she would have gotten exposure to women like that in a place like New York City.
Mm-hmm. I feel like we'd be remiss not to mention the breakdown did come after this, but this was not necessarily, there's a connection, but it's not necessarily that she spent this month and immediately had a breakdown because of the month, correct? Is that how you see it?
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Right. I really don't think it's that simple. You know, certainly that sort of thing can happen if someone has a really traumatic experience or something like that. But that wasn't the case here. I don't think that thing happened, you know, a month can cause a breakdown if the worst things that happen are a little bit of disappointment and you're working too hard.
Right.
You know, it was obviously other things. And I think that a lot of it had to do with just feeling very, very torn and trapped and resentful that she had such less freedom than a man would.
Right.
And she was angry. She was very, very angry, especially around the time that she was 19 or 20 and 21. She was angry that she didn't have, that she had to choose between this or that, and men didn't have to. And I think that had a lot to do with it.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for talking to us today. Any idea who you're going to be writing about next?
Yeah, I do, but I'm sort of afraid to say. But I can say that it's a very, very similar time period, and it's someone that everybody knows.
Ooh.
So, and it's a woman, because I don't think I'd ever write about a man.
I've had that thought too. Yeah.
So it's a woman.
Okay.
Yeah, but it's very new, and I'm still just kind of in the very beginning stages.
Understandable. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I've been talking today with Elizabeth Winder about Payne Party's work, Sylvia Plath in New York, the summer of 1953. I'm Oline Eaton. This is New Books in Biography. Thanks for listening.